I used to be really into fly fishing. People would sort of know me for that. But in 2021, in early summer, there was a heat wave and drought conditions, and hoot owl restrictions were implemented like way earlier than normal, which meant that fishermen and anglers were supposed to stay off the streams between 2 p.m. and midnight. They were trying to protect trout from more stress. It was around the same time, 2021 and 2023, that the Big Hole River in western Montana experienced a trout collapse. You know, historically, you used to be able to find like 3,000 trout per mile, and now it's down to about 500. In 2021, I started reckoning with my own relationship to fly fishing. I thought, this is a sport for me. It's just recreation. It's catch and release. I don't need it for subsistence or for food. And so I made the difficult and also not very difficult decision to just stop fly fishing. Like, I could just go swimming instead, or I could just sit on the bank and read a book. There was nothing that compelled me to put more stress on a species just for my recreation. So the last trout I caught effectively was Thanksgiving of 2020. I'm Sarah Aronson, a climate-aware psychotherapist, which means I'm trained to understand the complex psychological distress related to the climate crisis, as well as how best to support coping, adaptation, and transformation in the face of paralyzing anxiety, loss, and change. Most days, I'm able to leave my client struggles within the four walls of my office. But when I started to hear the collective concern about a disappearing winter, and so many of my clients telling me it's not supposed to be like this, I felt it in my bones. I'm an unabashed winter lover, along with being an angler, and I rely on snowfall for my mental health during the dark months, as well as healthy streams during the hot months. One element of climate-aware therapy is helping clients feel less isolated and alone in their experience and not pathologizing reasonable climate-related feelings. Sometimes it means joining clients with a simple, yeah, me too. Throughout this season of grounding, I've talked with academics and experts in fields ranging from environmental philosophy to the pharmaceutical industry, which we'll get into this episode. I've tried to nail down what it means when our bodies seem to know that something is off with the seasons. What do we do with all our feelings, including numbness and moral injury, within an ever-changing environment while trying to manage the day-to-day? When it comes to the climate crisis, moral injury is the feeling of being forced to participate in systems we know cause harm to other people, places, and creatures. It's an injury to our own deep knowing of what is right and fair. In this episode, we're talking to a pharmacist who shares some pretty startling facts with me. One being that pharmaceuticals have been found in water bodies on every single continent, and that the packaging, manufacturing, and the distribution of drugs makes up 12% of healthcare's global carbon footprint. Haley Blackburn is a licensed pharmacist and professor at the University of Montana in Missoula. With other colleagues, Haley co-founded RX for Climate, a global alliance for climate-smart pharmacy practice. Haley and I touch on some of those wild statistics, but I also try and understand how she navigates her own moral injury.
I am Haley Blackburn. I'm an associate professor of pharmacy practice at the University of Montana in our School of Pharmacy here. I'm also co-founder of an organization called RX for Climate, which is a network of climate-concerned pharmacists all around the world working together on climate-related issues, both in the realm of sustainability as well as climate adaptation. I grew up in Seeley Lake, Montana, with a family. Both of my parents worked for the Forest Service, and I spent the majority of my childhood outside in nature and learned all the plants and animals and got to go into the Bob Marshall Wilderness with my dad. You know, lived this very cool childhood, really connecting with nature, but also had an interest in heading into the health profession. It became something that, you know, I went from the kid who loved nature and Captain Planet to this young adult who was interested in health and really saw climate as like, this is something I'm concerned about. I think anybody who works in healthcare looks around and thinks like, wow, here's all of this waste.
I can't resist saying I could still sing the Captain Planet theme song.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go Planet!
By your powers combined, I am Captain Planet.
Captain Planet, he's our hero, gonna take pollution.
Captain Planet and the Planeteers was a 1990s masterpiece about an environmental superhero created by Barbara Pyle and Ted Turner.
I would say that like my real climate moment, if we're looking for some sort of keystone event or something, was in 2017. It was when I was moving back to take this job as a faculty member. My parents still live in Sealy Lake, Montana. So they were up close and personal with the Rice Ridge Fire in 2017. And I remember actually being in the process of moving from, I was in Oregon at the time, along the North Umpqua River, Roseburg, Oregon. And actually having a wildfire start there as I was packing my stuff up and getting ready to leave and come back to Montana, and looking and watching this fire encroach on this area of nature that I just like had grown to love so much while I was living there, and talking to my parents on the phone simultaneously saying, what are you doing? Get out. Dad, no, you are not going to stay and fight the fire with your tractor. No, get out. Are you kidding? If there's evacuation orders, get out.
The Rice Ridge Fire burned over 100,000 acres northeast of Sealy Lake, Montana. It was caused by lightning strike in drought conditions and became the nation's top wildfire priority in September of 2017. The wildfire season in Montana in 2017 was really intense. Sealy Lake spent weeks with air quality off the charts. Public health officials were urging residents not to sleep in town and ordered an evacuation. One of our guests from episode one, Jen Robum, described not being able to see her mailbox in Sealy Lake that summer. 2017 was also my entry into climate psychology. Smoke was literally showing up in my office when I was meeting with clients. It's kind of hard not to bring climate change into mental health conversation at that point.
I think that there's just has historically been a lack of awareness even within the healthcare system itself, even among healthcare professionals. I think that it's understandable. The average healthcare professional is asked to hold so many different things and to do so much to take care of patients in front of them. And so I think that some of it is just the lack of awareness of the people who are steeped in it every single day. And I think that also on the patient side of things, maybe there isn't always an appreciation of how many bags of trash are getting hauled out and how much plastic waste is happening. And, you know, or maybe it's people are somewhat conscious of it, but it's not front of mind. If you're sick, you're not thinking about that. You're thinking about your basic needs and getting well and taking care of mom or taking care of your kid or whatever. And so I think that it's easy for that to, at least in the moment, go by the wayside. There are other more pressing things that people are worried about.
I'm sitting here with you thinking, what kind of mind do you have to be able to hold all of this then, Haley? Right? The cognitive dissonance of that, the sort of moral injury, that's part of what we're talking about here today, to be forced to participate in systems that you know are wasteful or cause harm. Why? Why would you do this to yourself?
Why? I think that the healthcare system more generally, even outside, set aside the waste and the climate impact and everything, is inflicts so much moral injury on people. And often that has to do with not being able to take care of people the way you would like, having to say, I'm sorry, you know, you can't afford your medication. I'm sorry that, you know, we can't get you into the specialist for 6 months. I'm sorry. Nobody went into the healthcare system to have to do that or say that. We went into it because we wanted to help people and we wanted to like do the right thing. So I think that moral injury component existed for me before the climate awareness.
Moral injury exists in the systems we have to live within too. Like all the single-use plastic that's convenient for us. But for Haley, zooming out, she saw ways to address sustainability in the pharmaceutical world.
What is an ideal healthcare experience for patients, for providers, for pharmacists, for administrators? And it's, you know, it's that you can take care of people, that people can be healthy. And that actually runs in line with that also being sustainable too.
I was hoping that we could start with some basic facts about the climate impacts of the pharmaceutical industry, that it has the greenhouse gas emissions 55% higher than the auto industry. Give us some just like off the top heavy hitters.
In the United States, our healthcare system accounts for, you see numbers, anywhere between 7 to 10% of our total carbon footprint of the country. So significant chunk of our carbon emissions. And of that, if we slice that pie down, we see somewhere around 20 to 25% of those emissions coming from pharmaceuticals and other chemicals. It's also really energy intensive. There are a lot of things that go into making drugs. You know, so it's actually this very, very resource intensive process to get the drugs in front of the person. I think the other thing that's important as far as like a high level statistic is that they found detectable levels of pharmaceuticals in the water on every single continent on the planet, including Antarctica, including remote regions of Svalbard.
Just think about that for a second. Pharmaceuticals have been detected in bodies of water on every single continent, even in remote Antarctica. 25% of the samples were at high enough levels to be harmful to ecosystems or contribute to antimicrobial resistance, according to a recent study. Globally, 40 to 50% of people waste drugs on some level.
Let's think about in a hospital or something where we have a container, a vial of a drug that we are drawing up in an operating room or in the emergency department or something, and we don't use all of that in that tiny vial, and that goes into the trash or goes in whatever waste stream. That's one type of drug waste. There's also waste associated with maybe you're stuck on that auto refill treadmill and the drugs keep coming, whether or not you're actually taking them on a daily basis. And, you know, how many people have unused prescription medications in their cupboard at home? In addition to thinking about all of the over-the-counter drugs, all of the supplements and things that we purchase, particularly in countries like the United States, in these high-income countries where direct-to-consumer marketing, you know, we're going to have kind of a pill for every ill, those sorts of things, we end up contributing to a lot of unused product that's just sitting there. And that may go into the trash, that may go down the toilet, that may go a lot of different places. But basically, I think broadly, when I say drug waste, it's any drug that was created and not given to a patient where the patient takes it as intended. And so whether that is, you know, what point in the pathway in that life cycle that is wasted.
I also asked Haley to get specific about how pharmaceuticals interact with animal species. Though it's an emerging area of research, she said we know there are hormonal and reproductive impacts, which she emphasized are critical when thinking about how a species continues or collapses within larger ecosystems. And this brings us back to our fish friends. Remember at the beginning of this episode when I talked about fly fishing and how I stopped because the temperatures were too warm to fish responsibly? And going farther back, remember when our guest Hannah Dusick in episode 3 challenged audience members with their role in the extinction of species? Well, Haley learned that in addition to a warming climate, human drugs are having an impact on fish ecosystems too.
Another thing that we know, there are antidepressants in the water that can change behavior of, particularly like there are studies of fish where it's like fish get exposed to Prozac in the water and we have really chilled out fish, but that means that those chilled out fish aren't seeking out prey or avoiding predators or mating or engaging in behaviors that that population would need to survive and thrive in the ecosystem.
Months ago, when I heard this from Haley during a climate and health conference, I was shocked. It caused me to think back to the trout in my home streams, wondering if they too were chilled out and swimming in Prozac water. The pharmaceutical industry is part of the healthcare sector, whose climate footprint is so large that if it were a country, it would be the fifth largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world, surpassed only by China, the US, India, and Russia. Haley was the lead author on a study about pharmaceutical waste and the environment, published in August 2024, that added its own statistics to that picture.
The highlight from that study is that I think that we don't necessarily appreciate drugs for kind of the resource-intensive product that they are. Often in the healthcare system or in day-to-day consumption of drugs, we look at them and say, well, were they really expensive? Were they hard to get? And if the answer is no, then it's no big deal. Toss that Tylenol in the trash. I think one of the things that I wanted to highlight in that study is it's not only economic implications of us wasting these medications, it's these upstream effects of carbon emissions. We have like 1 in 3 people in the United States that say they're not taking their medications as directed due to cost because they can't afford it. We have the system that is wasteful and yet leaving people behind.
Haley, you and I work on complementary ends of mental health treatment. I do talk therapy. You work in pharmaceuticals, which medications are often prescribed to support all kinds of DSM conditions. I was hoping we could talk a little bit about medication interaction and the climate crisis. For instance, can you help remind folks about the interactions between a warming climate and SSRIs?
I think it's important for people to be aware of the medications that are very, very common out there that actually impact our body's ability to regulate our temperature when we're exposed to hot weather. SSRIs definitely being one of those. Not only are they in the water chilling out all of our fish, they are potentially medications that can impact somebody's ability to keep their body cool during hot weather, which can increase risk of heat exhaustion, heat stroke, and we're finding now all sorts of other potential complications associated with our bodies getting too hot and having cardiovascular events and things like that. You know, if we went down the list of all of the medications that potentially impact the body's ability to regulate temperature during heat, it's a massive amount of the population that is actually taking at least one of those medications.
As a reminder, SSRIs are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or one class of antidepressants. And to add on to what Haley said, it's not just antidepressants like fluoxetine or Prozac, but also antipsychotics and even blood pressure medications that can have unintended consequences for users when combined with a warming climate. Imagine trying to go for a normal weekend hike in the summer and not being able to sweat. Something that regulates your body's temperature. You might have to take more breaks, cool off in a stream, or consider not going at all. I've had clients who've experienced this. They were trying to do 3 good things for their mental health: physical activity, getting outside, and taking a prescription they know is helpful for them. But the combination made being outside hard, if not intolerable. And in other cases, medications people rely on to breathe, like inhalers, are adding greenhouse gases to the environment. That's a pretty bleak-sounding paradox, and one that really gets at the system-level problem that Haley grapples with. It's a feedback loop that leads to negative consequences, and it's also self-reinforcing.
Thinking about all of the downstream consequences of climate change, whether that's respiratory conditions because people have been exposed to wildfire smoke, increasing our use of inhalers, which it turns out the propellants in the inhalers. So those asthma inhalers that, you know, your classic albuterol inhaler, the propellants inside those are actually really, really potent greenhouse gases. So anywhere between 1500 to 3000 times more potent than carbon dioxide in terms of global warming potential. So even though it's a very small amount of gas in that canister, it's actually contributes a significant amount. When they estimated this in the UK, it was something between 3 to 5% of their overall healthcare footprint was solely attributed to the propellants in those inhalers. That means also that we can shift things in the other direction if we have that feedback loop. Can we take care of people? Can we help support them and their mental health in ways that don't necessarily rely solely on drugs? Can we take care of the climate? Can we build healthier, more connected communities? Can we support healthy food systems? Can we do all of these things that are aligned with climate goals? And oh, guess what? They're also aligned with healthier people, a more sustainable healthcare system, and just like a better world.
Can you offer some basic tips for folks on how to manage their medication as it relates to climate impact? Like, Haley, I know I have a bottle of a decade-old malaria medication.
Guess what? Me too. I think that there are some things that people can do. So one, being mindful of the way that they store their drugs so that they're not inadvertently and prematurely like cooking their drugs in a mailbox or something and needing to discard them unnecessarily. The other thing is just thinking about, okay, what can I do to appropriately dispose of the medications if I do have them and I need to get rid of them? There are a couple of different pathways. This is, again, one of those that's a little bit tricky. So we often promote drug take back, and that is a really good thing, particularly for drugs like opioids, where we're concerned about maybe diversion into the community, accidental overdose because a kid gets into the medicine cabinet and takes it or whatever. And so there's a big push to get those back through official channels and destroyed appropriately. But we promote drug take back more generally from the standpoint of trying to keep drugs out of our waterways and out of our environment. Because it turns out if you flush medications down the toilet, you assume, okay, well, that goes through a wastewater treatment facility, right? Yes, but it turns out that most wastewater treatment processes are not particularly efficient at removing most drugs. And our drinking water standards don't include active pharmaceutical drugs in there. So we're not really monitoring, necessarily regulating. They're voluntary measures that certain wastewater treatment facilities can take to get those medications out of the water. But if you're flushing them, they are going into our waterways.
Again, systems problems. Flush the drugs and potentially harm our fish friends or end up drinking it yourself? Burn it and risk pumping the air full of pollutants? If it feels like for every environmental problem, there isn't a clear black and white answer when you think there should be, you're not alone. Season 2 of Grounding is all about dissonance and the tensions we feel living our day-to-day lives, all the while knowing that our very lifestyles are having an impact. When you move through your daily life, where do you experience the most amount of tension or dissonance between your values and what it takes to live or even enjoy life in Montana? Like for me, Haley, 2021, we had hoot owl restrictions for fly fishing in June, which normally we don't see those until August or late July. And for me, I was like, I don't think I can fly fish this summer. Like I can't stress out fish. Like that would hurt me to hurt them. Where do you feel like this kind of tension as a Montanan?
More broadly, maybe not just specifically as a Montanan, some of the tension or some of the things that I reflect on is, I will disclose I've been to two international conferences this year where I've flown long distances to go engage around climate and health. It's like the people flying their private jets to Davos sort of thing, where I experienced that. I'm like, hey, what am I doing? What's the ultimate dissonance of taking this action to do this? And is this really worth it? And, I think that I've ultimately come to the conclusion that from those trips and those opportunities, I've been able to make a lot of connections globally that have ultimately allowed me to do things on a bigger scale in terms of advocating for policy, in terms of connecting with like-minded people on the other side of the world, expanding networks. And also, I've had opportunities to get these ideas in front of hundreds of people. And so, you know, maybe that's an excuse, an apology for the carbon emissions associated with flying. But I think that it gets to that idea of the, you know, the way that systems are structured right now, it feels impossible to be a purist in the way that you do things.
Sometimes we use a psychological defense called justification to mediate cognitive dissonance. For me, I tell myself that because I bike commute most of the year, I can justify driving hours to a Nordic ski location in the winter. It's not exactly a clean mental exchange, but I've been known to do it. In a moment of devil's advocacy, I asked Haley if there's anything morally injurious about the fact that we might need to take drugs to help us deal with our anxiety and depression related to the climate crisis. Is that a systems level problem too?
I wouldn't ever want the healthcare sustainability conversation to be about, do I receive the care that I need, or do I save the planet? I think that those need to be thought of together, and we need to consider the potential negative externalities of the healthcare system more broadly and be aware of those things. And that's absolutely something, but I don't think any individual should look at any type of rationing of care or forgoing anything that is needed for the sake necessarily of environmental concerns. I think that certainly asking those questions about environmental impact, consumer advocacy is important. I think that being mindful that those things do exist, but no.
So Captain Planet fights villains and criminals who pollute the environment, but it turns out healthcare's not the villain here. But patients have a right to advocate for more environmentally friendly practices, including when it comes to what's in their medicine cabinets. If you're interested in learning more about the intersection of healthcare and sustainability, visit Montana Health Professionals for a Healthy Climate at www.montanahphc.org. Next episode, I'm talking with two environmental philosophers about our relationships with the more than human, including the age-old question, are humans a part of nature or not? Grounding is hosted by me, Sarah Aronson. Keely Larson is our executive producer. Editorial support from Lauren Korn and Claire Menahan. Engineering by Chris Moyles. Thanks to Michael Marsalek and Nick Mott. The theme song is by Brian Ramirez. Grounding is an independent production of Montana Public Radio's Arts and Culture team.